Roll 2d6, show number 12. Welcome to Roll 2d6, with Adam and Nate, a podcast about games, gaming, and gamers.
Hi everyone, this is Roll 2d6. Game on, everybody. With me as always is Nate.
Game on, Adam.
Game on, Nate. We're coming to you live from the 14th floor of the Gaming Basement Tower, filmed live before a studio audience that has been instructed to be completely silent.
Yeah, we're talking about you in the blue shirt on the third row. Pipe down, we're recording.
And we're here to talk about games, specifically to talk about all the cool games that we played at KublaCon 2006.
Yes, you may remember in our last podcast, if you were there for it, that we were all excited about the con, which was to be held May 26th through May 29th here in the Bay Area. We managed to play a lot of games, and we both had a blast.
Yes, indeed we did, and I got to play a number of games that I had heard about or read about, and for the most part, I think I liked just about everything I played this year.
Me too. Currently, my only complaint with KublaCon is that it needed to go a couple more days, because there was more things that I wanted to play but didn't have a chance to.
Oh, yeah.
So, shall we?
Yes. Well, let's start by going through from Friday to Monday of that weekend and talk about all the games that we played. I'm going to go a little bit fast here because we played a lot of games and I don't want this podcast to end up being 2 hours long. Although we may just cut it and make it two episodes. Who knows? I was taking pictures of everything that I played as well as lots of other interesting stuff that I saw but didn't play. And I was uploading them on the fly to my Flickr account. So anyone on their computer can go right now to the Roll2D6 Flickr account and there will be a link on the show notes and follow along with my pictures.
So, yeah, it's a great... It can now become a multimedia experience rather than just listening on the podcast when you're exercising or in your car or something. If you're sitting in front of your computer, it's like a slideshow if you're
That's
willing
right.
to click a little bit.
Just imagine the drone of the slide projector and the dust coming out of the fan and we're all set.
Yes.
Okay, so the first game that we played on Friday was Formula Day. And in fact, this event was called Giant Formula Day and the guy running it had a gigantic table size racetrack map which all the players used. We had about 12 players total in this game, and I had never played this game before, but I found it to be a lot of fun. This is an auto racing game, of course, with players moving cars around a track, and these are Formula One type cars, not NASCAR or Sprint or something.
Right.
The number of spaces you move is determined by a die roll, and the die you roll is determined by what gear you're in. So if when you're in first gear, you roll a D4, in second gear, you roll a D6, and so on, up to the highest gear, which is sixth gear, and in that gear, you roll a D30.
Well, you know, this actually goes into one of the few pet peeves I have about Formula Day, was the irregular distributions on the dice. When you say a D30 or even a D6, you don't necessarily get a regular distribution of numbers across those. So I had a hard time, even though it goes, oh, yeah, you're rolling a D12. There was a lot more of some numbers than others, and it was...
Yeah, you have to know ahead of time that these are not standard dice.
Yes.
And it did say that on the car control sheet, what the distribution was for each die.
Yeah.
But they didn't point
but
that out
to us.
But it kept
throwing me off. They didn't point that out. It was something we sort of had to discover eventually.
Yeah, these are not standard dice. They have certain numbers repeated. So, like, when you're in fifth gear and you roll a 20-sided die, it actually has numbers 11 through 20, which are repeated twice.
Right.
So I guess that's so that, you know, someone who's in first gear is never going to go faster than someone in fifth gear.
Yeah.
Makes sense, I suppose. So this game, you know, it really recreated for me the fast-paced nature of auto racing. You're speeding up for the really long straightaways, rolling that 30-sided die and going 25 spaces.
Yeah.
And you have to slow down and jam on the brakes for those tight curves. And there's a game mechanic which requires you to end a certain number of moves in each of the tight turn areas. And for me, that really brought home the sense of jamming your brakes on to make that tight turn.
Right. I really liked, they also had the mechanic for how are your tires, are your tires holding up, you know, you can burn rubber on your tires in order to slow down quicker.
Yeah.
And then you know, if you suffer a blowout, then you have problems that way. It was a really nice little mechanic, and it was easy to pick up, too.
Oh, yeah, it was very easy to keep track of your fuel, your tires, your body damage, and collisions with other players damaging your body. And all in all, it's a fun game. I'd play this again, although it's not a particularly heavy game. It's pretty lightweight, but it's fun and fast. And in fact, I found myself wanting to mod the rules to include some Car Wars type weapons.
I know you did. You were sitting there. If I could only shoot the guy in front of me, I'd be much happier.
drop some mines right at that tight turn. The next game we played after that was Monster Island. And we played a variant of this, but let me explain the base game. It's actually a simple tabletop battle system for creating movie monster battles of the type that you would see in Godzilla or Gamera movies.
I love those things, especially the Mystery Science Theater 3000 treatments of the Gamera movies.
Those are great. Gamera versus Megalon.
That's right. Gamera versus Giron.
Giron, yeah. The game actually comes as a book with all the rules. It doesn't come with any Gamera figures or anything. You supply those with toys and figures from around the house. And it does come with some cardboard counters that you can fold out and use as stand-ups. But
you're supposed to go get your plastic dinosaur from somewhere and put your plastic dinosaur on the table to be your Godzilla.
Oh, yeah. And it works great for that. And you can scale it to any level depending on what size your toys are.
Right.
So these are just things around the house.
You could actually have like a really huge teddy bear fighting a really small dinosaur, and the huge teddy bear might win because it's huge, right?
There's
an actual scaling for the size of the pieces you put on there.
And so there's stats in the book for all kinds of giant monster types, from big robots or giant lizards or whatever. And you can create all kinds of battles. You supply your own map, and you usually use a tabletop or living room floor or whatever for the battlefield. And it looks like a fun game, and we actually picked this up. The guy who was running our game, however, did not use monsters. He instead used superheroes.
Yeah.
And what he did is he had a whole bunch of HeroClix commons, and which I guess you can just get for cheap. And he created stats for all of these superheroes and supervillains using the Monster Island rule system. And then they fought it out on a battlefield that was scattered with various items to throw at each other.
Right. It was really fun. It was nice to see. He did augment it a little bit with the... He borrowed a couple things from the hero system, from Champions, in order to sort of distinguish between one guy's sort of, you know, one guy's hand-to-hand combat style and another guy's. But essentially, it was the fast and easy system of Monster Island, and it was a lot of fun to have, you know, things flying back and forth, exploding, and throwing stuff around.
Throwing cars and boats and airplanes at each other. That was great.
Yeah.
There was just a couple of complaints when Captain America was as powerful as some of the wimpier supervillains.
Yeah, we had some of the wimpier supervillains that would have a hard time, you know, stealing an old lady's purse. And they were balanced with the Captain America figure so that Captain America was getting his butt kicked by, you know, some decrepit old villain. But other than that, it was good.
Yeah, it was fun. So fun quick system. I definitely would play that again.
Yeah.
Next, after that, we played Shadows Over Camelot. Now, this is one of those big games that has been out for a while, but, you know, I've never played it. But like last year, Days of Wonder had a big booth at KublaCon, and they had created a giant 3D board for this game in order to teach it to new players. Last year, we played Pirate's Cove on their giant 3D Pirate's Cove board, and that was a lot of fun.
Right.
And their board was beautiful last year. I didn't like the 3D Shadows Over Camelot board as much.
It was a little harder to tell what was going on with that particular board. They were trying to make some of the things like where to put your cards that stack. They tried to make them very muted and inobvious, and in doing so, they ended up making it look... It looks more like just a generic terrain than a game board, and it was kind of hard to see what was going on.
Yeah. But you know, it was effective, and it worked. And
it was a great spectacle, though. You have this big, giant 3D terrain board with the trees and the grass and the big giant castle
in the corner, and
you got everyone and their dog coming over to look and see what the game is. It's a really effective, eye-grabbing tactic for Days of Wonder.
Oh yeah, definitely. So I don't know what I can say about this game that hasn't already been said, but you know, it's a cooperative game. All the players, of which you probably have around six to eight, are playing Knights of Camelot that are trying to beat back the forces of darkness.
Yes.
And at the start of the game, the thing that it makes it a twist so that it's not completely just a cooperative game is all the players draw a card from this certain deck, and there's a chance that one of the players is secretly a traitor who is working for trying to help the forces of darkness but not letting anyone else know.
Yeah, one of the things that I really liked about this game was that because of that secret traitor and some of the mechanic, it was just oh so dark. It was not a happy game. I've never had a game where I felt like darkness was slowly whittling me down to nothing, and I was watching the inevitable destruction creep and strangle us. And hey, I'd play that again.
That's right. Yeah, I had an okay time playing it, but it seems like this is a game that you would really need lots of players to have a good game on. I don't think... seems like you would really need at least six players to have a decent game of this.
I know. I can't imagine getting together six or seven people. I mean, I have a hard enough time getting together, you know, three or four to play a game. I can't imagine trying to get together seven to play a full round of this.
I can count on fingers of one hand the number of times I've played a six-player game, and all of them at cons.
That's right. Once a year, all the six-player games you want.
Yeah, I know. So the end of our game was kind of funny, though, the game that you and I were both in.
Yeah.
We had all gotten down to just one life point left, except for one of the knights who had two life points left. And this is after everyone starts out with about 4 to 5 life points. And then someone drew one of the black cards, which is the cards for the Forces of Darkness, and it was a card that does 1 point of damage to everyone at the table. And so, of course, that instantly killed 6 out of the 7 of us, and the remaining player was the winner by default.
Yes. It was automatic. So,
it was one of those things that if I had played this game before and knew that there was a card that does 1 point of damage to everyone, I might have not let myself get down to one. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, I didn't realize that card was in there either. Maybe I should have asked or something.
So we were all playing and we're figuring out who the traitor, and then suddenly someone draws a card and bam, game over.
Yeah.
One guy wins. And he wasn't the traitor.
And
King Arthur was the traitor in that game, strangely enough.
But it was true.
He was taken over by the Forces of Darkness.
That's right.
The last game of the night that would be played on Friday was Thunder and Guns, which is one of my favorite light games to end the night with.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about this in the previous podcast. There were 6 players this time, and this time, instead of being the bandit, I was one of the outlaws, one of the gunslingers, El Supremo, who was a Mexican bandito.
Yes.
And as usual, I was not a very good bandito, and I only managed to get one of the NPCs to join my gang. And Nate, you got to play the bandit, the outlaw gang. How did that go?
I did. It was really hard, and I'll tell you why. I had the worst die rolls in the world, because the win condition for the outlaw is don't get taken to jail and steal X number of units of gold from various safes around. And in order to get into safes, you have to have dynamite, and dynamite is in limited supply in the game.
Yep.
So if someone picks up a dynamite somewhere and uses it for some reason, the chance of you being able to get all the gold that you need quick enough is really slim. And meanwhile, there's a sheriff player who's going around trying to recruit people who just... eventually, he ends the game. Once he gets to a certain amount of fame, X number of turns later, he wins. And so you sort of have a time limit, and in order to get in under the time limit, you've got to be picking up gold from turn one, and you've got to be blowing up safes from turn one and turn two.
You got to really work
fast. You've got to hustle for that. And I was trying so hard, and every time I'd roll for my dynamite to see if I blew it open, I got nothing. And so I spent a lot of time wasting dynamite, and it was pretty bad.
That was what happened with me last year when I was the bandit and or the outlaw gang, and I managed 3 times to try to blow open the safe of the bank, and each time I failed to do so. So
yeah,
it's very tough to win as the outlaw gang. And I, as you said, I think the sheriff won that game.
Yeah.
So fun game.
Next
morning, which would be Saturday, I guess, I played in a session of Battle Stations, and we talked about this in, I believe, episode 5. So go listen to that. I was a Kenosian scientist named Clack, and our mission was to find out what was happening at a starbase that had gone out of control. And it turned out that the robots had taken over the station and were being endlessly created out of the very substance of the station due to a rogue computer virus that had taken them over. And it eventually even affected the 2 robots on board our ship, which turned on us, and we had to try to take them down.
Yeah, I just want to step just slightly away from the game. They put this game in the RPG section of the convention.
Yeah.
And I think based on the high energy nature of this particular game and the fact that it's more like, you know, people standing around and moving pieces, and there was all sorts of... Well, and the GM, you know, fun, nice guy, but he liked to shout.
He was a very shouter. Intense person.
And we were a little too loud for our neighbors, who kept shooting us dirty looks the whole time. I had a hard time getting into the game, because every time I'd look around the room, all these people having, you know, dramatic, you know, moments within their RPGs are all of a sudden getting, like, shouted down by either one of our players or our GM. I think it would have been better to not do this in the RPG section, but down in the war game section, where they're not so close together, they're a little farther apart, and people are used to standing over the table and shouting at each other, which was usually not the case in the RPG room.
Yeah, most of the time, well, when I played in one of the RPG sessions a couple of years ago with when Joey ran the Ghostbusters RPG, we had a room to ourselves. And I think most of them, they do that. It's just that some of them they put into a room where you have two games going on opposite ends of one little boardroom. Right. And that's where we were, and it was it's bad for whichever team is not the loud one.
Yeah. The game itself was kind of fun. The guy was mixing some rules with some unreleased rules, and so I had a hard time understanding what was going on and why certain things were happening and why they weren't.
Yeah.
Because he threw in a couple of mixed rules, a couple of house rules.
He was putting in some stuff from the next expansion, which is not yet out.
Yeah, yeah. And but it was fun.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well. We eventually beamed over some Marines, and eventually I think nearly everyone on the ship beamed over, and we managed to shut down all the robots just in time, which is the way a battle station's mission should end.
That's right.
Barely succeeding
barely successful.
Against terrible odds.
Yes.
So after that, that took, I think, all morning. I think that was about 4 hours. Then we went to a giant version of Memoir 44. They have a lot of these giant versions at KublaCon where they just basically take the board and blow it up really big. And as we know, all games are better when they're huge.
That's right. We're going to have a section on ways to make your game more fun. And one of them is to increase the size of the game.
That's right, because when you have to pick up that pawn with both hands, it's that much more fun.
That's right. So, that's why they always have the giant chess matches in in movies, television, and D&D adventures.
That's right.
Moving giant chess pieces makes it that much more fun.
So we played Giant Memoir 44, and this is another game that I've heard and read a lot about, had never played it until the con. And it's a fairly simple hex map strategy game with a World War II theme. I would not call this a war game, but it's sort of a war-themed strategy game.
Right, right.
You're not really trying to simulate any specific battle of World War II, just sort of moving pieces around that are units that are kind of like the ones that were in World War II.
Right.
So since it was a giant game board, it was split into three sections on each side, and I was on the... This was Russians versus Germans in our game. I was on the Russian side. I think you were on the German side.
Yes.
And so there's three sections with a separate player for each section, and then a general who is supposed to be commanding all of the separate players for each section. So it's a four-on-four, basically.
Right.
And I thought it was fun, although I was sort of moving at random until I grasped the strategy to moving about halfway through the game, and then I think I started to do a little better.
Right. You know, I kind of like the command structure of the eight-person variant of the game. The leading general is the guy that drew and got the cards and handed them out to the different field commanders.
Oh, yep.
And...
Oh, and the other rule they had is that the general could only conference with one of the three people per turn.
Right. He could only talk to one of them, and he could hand cards to any of them.
Yeah.
And so this made it good and bad. I mean, it was good in the sense that if you're going to have eight players playing what's generally a one-person-on-one-person game, it's a good way to divvy it up, and it's sort of fun to have that, battle, the big general and the smaller field commanders in a way. The bad part that I had with it is that the field commanders have little or no info on how the greater scheme of the battle is working. And so
you just sort of have to look across the board and try to see how the other guys are doing.
Right. I mean, and there are things that I know I could have done to help out, but maybe our major general guy or whoever was in charge was not seeing them or not caring. He often told me to just keep my opponent busy. And so I just kept my side of the map busy, and I kind of feel like I wanted to contribute to the overall strategy. So it was good, but mixed. It was a good variant.
Yeah, fun game. I'd play that again.
Oh, yeah, I want to play the one-on-one version now from now on.
Yeah, we'll have to pick up a copy of this at some point. And this is one
that's on my birthday list now.
Oh, all right. There's like a zillion expansions for this now. There's a base, and the one that we played was actually one of the expansions.
Yeah, we played on the Eastern Front there.
I don't know which of those we can play, but we'll find one.
Yeah.
Next, we played one of the demo sessions of HeroScape, then. These were running all day long. They had some really nice, gigantic HeroScape maps.
Yeah,
and they had a bunch of sets all put together and had a whole ton of miniatures for it. And it was fun. It was nice-looking terrain, of course, and miniatures, and simple rules, easy to pick up. Yeah. And I see now why Joey loves to play this with his kids.
Yeah, he told me that he had it set up, and his kids like to play it. It's a simple and looks good.
Yeah, and the guys running the demo were pretty helpful and explained how to play. I mean, there's not a whole lot to this game.
It's not a very deep well of strategy to this game.
The movement and the firing is pretty simple, and then some of the strategy comes into each unit's special ability, I believe.
Right.
Where you're trying to manage your special abilities and watch out for the special abilities of the enemy units.
Right.
And you know, I'd play this again. I think I'm not sure. This is kind of expensive for the sets, but it looks like you get a lot of replay value out of it if you replay it.
Yeah, if you replay it. Well, but you know, they sort of have like, I almost want to say like the collectible card game or the HeroClix thing going. I mean, if you want a different set of rules or some new sorts of guys, you go buy the new pack. And
yeah, well,
you know,
I mean, they're not
the
like
constantly. And
yeah, I mean, it's nice to have all these new units. They're not like, it's not like with the CCG where you don't know what you're getting and you have to buy a lot to get the rares.
That's true.
So you can just get the ones you want, which is, at least I think that's the way it is. Huh?
Yeah, that is better. No, you can see everything in those packs. I was looking at them the other day at the store.
And I like that they have a mixture of all kinds of units, you know, ancient fantasy units, historical, modern, and sci-fi future units.
Yeah, so I really liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun to have, because it was nice, it was light, it was quick and dirty. The only downside that I see to it, if I'm going to be fair about this, is that it almost seemed like, you know, the different guys, the special abilities were the rules. I mean, you generally had the movement and their basic attack, but it was their special abilities that let you know what else they could do that's different. And I have a hard time with the idea of having a game where I have to relearn to play every new figure I get. And it's like playing rock, paper, scissors played with a periodic table, some huge, you know, thing of what they could possibly be.
Well, you know, if you had the set, like even the base set with its 20 or so units, you would eventually learn what they all do, memorize them. And
well, right, but yeah, that's true. And if we just stayed with the base set, you'd eventually memorize what they all could do, and then I would be min-maxing until I could have the team that I wanted to play best. But
well, you know, I really liked HeroScape, I'll say that. I like having all these different units, and I like the game being different every time.
Right.
And, you know, as I look back, I'm doing a small aside here, as I look back at the games that I have really enjoyed over the years, I notice a trend. And I like the games in which you control a number of units on the board, and each of these units has separate detailed stats, hit points, or whatever, and special abilities, and the units fight other units. And this describes a lot of games that I've played over the years. Battletech, Blood Bowl, HeroScape Now, Duel of Ages, which I played recently, Battle Stations, and even Car Wars.
Right. Just some are more complex than others, but for the most part, they're small, individualized pawns fighting each other.
For some reason, this is a type of game that really appeals to me. So we'll see. I'm sure there's others I can't remember now. And
Runebound.
Runebound. Runebound, I thought that was okay.
But you only control one on Runebound.
You only control
he's
one.
He's a small, individual guy fighting other things.
That's true. That there was that. I did enjoy that. Although you're not fighting the other characters. You're fighting cards that you draw.
Right. That's true.
But I don't know if that counts for that. But anyway, moving on. After this, we played Dune. This is a very complex, out-of-print Avalon Hill game.
Hey, is there any other kind? They're all complex. Most of them are out of print. Go on.
Now that Avalon Hill is owned by Hasbro, I think they're all out of print.
Yeah.
So this is a game that is, of course, based on the Frank Herbert book Dune.
One of my favorite science fiction books of all time.
Oh, yes. Excellent, excellent book. And it includes all... This game includes all the complex political machinations that were featured in that novel. Each player plays one of the six factions, and they are the Guild, the Emperor, the Harkonnen, the Atreides, the Bene Gesserit, and the Fremen.
Yep.
And each of them has special powers and tricks they can do. They can each break some of the rules in the game in their own certain way, which is interesting. And so they're all unequal powers, but sort of are all balanced with each other by the special abilities.
Right.
And it's a combination of military maneuvering of your units on the map of Arrakis, and political maneuvers via other cards and powers. Mm-hmm. Lots of alliances, treachery, and backstabbing, just like the book. Yeah. And as I read a review of this, and they said that this is a game that, you know, despite whatever other problems it has, it is dripping with theme.
It is.
And that is indeed true. And this game seemed a little too complex for me. I did not get what was going on until the very end of the game. There was a lot of stuff happening, and I was sort of making moves at random and trying to figure out what was going on. I was playing the Fremen, and I had a couple of special abilities, and I was trying to use them, but I don't think I was doing things that was advancing me towards my goal.
Right, right. Yeah, I think... You know, we did play the French version of this game. It was reprinted in French.
That's
and so
right. It's
not
been out
having
of print.
The, not having the actual instructions in English at the time was maybe sort of a problem. I think the guy who was running it was, I mean, he was introducing his baby, as it were. He was like, mm-hmm. oh, I love to play this game. Everyone, you know, let's all play. And I think he could have prepared his intro shtick and rules explanations just a little better since we didn't have the real rules to fall back on. I mean, I spent a lot of time translating out of the French and looking up things, but...
Well, he had the printouts of all the rules and the printouts of all the cards and everything.
But
it was harder to look them up, and the
And you've
the
only
map
got one
spaces.
Copy and all of us playing at the same time.
Yeah, and then the map spaces were all in French. You know, I can puzzle out enough French to figure out the names of the territories and most of the cards, but we did have to look a lot of them up.
Yeah.
And that didn't make the game go any faster.
Right.
And, you know, the only reason he had the French one is because the U.S. one has been out of print so long, and that, you know, some French company got the rights to reprint it in France, and people, there's a demand for it here, so people just buy it off of eBay or whatever.
Right. I have one other quick aside on this.
Yeah.
While we were sitting there playing, the guy running the session of Dune right next to ours recognized our voices from the podcast. I think his name was Ken. So shout out to Ken. He actually, we actually met someone there at KublaCon who had heard of this podcast. And not only heard of it, but actually had heard the podcast. And
yeah, so thanks Ken for validating our existence as podcasters.
That's right, validated. And one other thing is I happen to recognize Ken from the first KublaCon game that I ever GM'd. He came to my
Star Trek
Tactical Combat Simulator game, and so it was nice to show. We could have sang It's a Small World for all night, but we decided not to.
So,
and by the way, Ken, if I've forgotten your name and it really isn't Ken, just know that it's you. But you really made my day to meet somebody who listens to the podcast. So
that's cool.
It was great.
Dune, this is one of those games, another one of those games, like Shadows Over Camelot, that really seems to come into its own with a large number of players, like six. And I've read some stuff on Board Game Geek. People say, you know, you really shouldn't play this with less than, like, four or five players.
Right.
And even four is pushing it. And so, you know, this... So
it's
as,
like diplomacy. It
yeah.
says 4-6 or 4-7, but you really want 6 or 7 there.
Yeah, and so, you know, this is another one of those games that I'm never going to play except for at KublaCon. When are you going
to
find six... hardcore Avalon Hill gamers that are also big fans of Frank Herbert's Dune.
Yeah, only at KublaCon.
Only at KublaCon.
Where people can sign up for it, yes.
Yep. So the next day after that, this was Sunday, I wandered around a lot, took lots of pictures in the morning, and then I played a game of Federation Space. And this is a game, another one, it seemed like an Avalon Hill game, but it wasn't. It's published in 1981 by Task Force Games, and this is the owner of the Starfleet Battles weird Star Trek license.
This is why it seemed like an Avalon Hill game, because Starfleet Battles is, like, incredibly complex, and so are the Avalon Hill games.
And it felt like an old-time Avalon Hill chit-stacking game.
Yeah.
You have
that's
a hex map.
Chit.
Yeah, you have a hex map of a part of the galaxy, centered on the Federation space, and you have Klingon space, Romulan space, and as well as the Kzinti, the Hydrans, the Gorn, and the Tholians all surrounding you.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of chits. Each chit represents a single ship or a squad of fighters. Combat rules are pretty simple. Each chit can be flipped over to a different set of stats so that your ships can be full strength or battle damaged. And apparently this game usually takes about 6 hours, and the con organizers had only scheduled 3 hours for him. When we started, the game organizer was saying, you know, we're not going to be able to finish the whole game. They only gave me 3 hours for this. So, but it was enough time for us to sort out our chits into fleets, stack our fleets on the map, and then for each of us to go through about one turn and get some battles in.
Wow. This reminds me of the very first time we played Babylon 5 Wars together, and that we had scheduled something like 3 hours to play, and we managed to get our ship sheets, read all the rules, get them all set up, get everything on the map, and move one turn before we had...
That's right. You almost need to just say, you know, I'm not going to accomplish anything in the first game. It's just a learning session.
That's right.
And so, let's see. I was the Federation, and I was in the middle of the map. And my Federation ships were doing pretty well. I think if we had gone much further, I would have eventually gotten overrun by the Klingon and Romulan ships that are coming at me from both sides. I was sort of allied with the Gorn and the Kzinti, and they were trying to also keep them busy on the sides, but yeah, I don't think I would have won that. But when we called it at 3 hours, we all decided that the Federation-Kzinti-Gorn alliance was the winner, so
I
did get a KublaCon pin out of that.
Excellent. You're a winner.
I did manage to kill a few Klingon ships, so that was good.
You satisfied their demands of honor. That's great.
I did. Let's see. Next after that, I played Merchant of Venus, and this is another out-of-print Avalon Hill game, sometimes described as a railroad game in space. And that's an apt description. I didn't think of that at the time, but afterwards I would agree with that. You have a map of the galaxy with various star systems, and you start out with a small ship. You move around the board from system to system and try to buy cargo for cheap and sell it for a higher price in another system. But the added twist is that you don't know which cultures are where until you explore them. So this would be like if in a railroad game, if you bought something cheap in one city but didn't know where you could sell it for higher until you went to another city and said, what's the price here?
Right. And you have to just take the rail wherever it leads. And,
that's right.
And go.
And so people are exploring around, and as you explore unknown space, you... put a chit down on the board, and then everyone knows what is demanded there and what is supplied there.
Oh, okay.
So you might have some cargo, but you have to explore around looking for buyers. And, you know, I liked this game, but there was not a whole lot of player interaction.
Uh-huh.
It is mostly just racing around and trying to make as much money as you can as fast as you can. The winner is the first person to get $1,500.
So you're not allowed to shoot at other people while you're
there
merchanting.
Was. Well, in the version we played, you weren't allowed to shoot, but we were playing, this was a non-combat variant. There's another version that does allow you to shoot at other players' ships.
Uh-huh.
And you can go to certain bases and buy weapons and buy shields, things like that. And then, you know, perhaps that would add more interaction. If someone's getting too far ahead, I could go hunt them down, try to destroy their ship or something.
Is it just me, or does this game seem sort of like a Robert Heinlein franchise?
It was Frederick Pohl wrote Merchants of Venus.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it does kind of seem like that when you play
his Citizen of the Galaxy juvie fiction stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I did get that feel as I was playing it, especially with the artwork. It's sort of a 60s type sci-fi
sort of Amazing
cover.
Tales cover,
yeah.
Or whatever that is. Yeah.
Exactly. Then the last day, this was Monday morning, I played one more Battle Stations event, and this turned out to be a pure RPG event. And the scenario was the Zoalan Olympics. Players were all Zoalans, which are the three-legged, three-armed cockroach-type characters.
Yes.
We were all Zoalan heroes that had just returned from a space mission, and we were participating in the Olympic Games back on the home planet. So we landed, we had to deal with our fans, then we went to the Queen's Palace, had a little bit of intrigue there, went to the games, competed in various events, and then had to prevent a last-minute kidnapping of the Queen. And all in all, it was not what I expected out of a Battle Stations game, but I thought it was still pretty fun.
Yeah, it seems like way more of an RPG than a
than
the board game.
Definitely. I mean, we only got the ship map out for the very last part, and most of it was just like a standard RPG. The game master's saying, okay, you're here, this is what you see, what do you want to do? And
right.
We tell him, and he tells us what happens. And
yeah.
Occasionally he'd be like, okay, roll, make a strength check to see if you can do that, or make a science check to see if you can spot that thing, or whatever.
Wow.
So, yeah, it wasn't bad.
Yeah, I actually came in at the end of that one to watch you finish that one up when he pulled out the map. I had spent my time during that time playing in a Ticket to Ride tournament that was happening. I ended up leaving the tournament early because it was the first time I'd ever played Ticket to Ride, and I was doing so poorly after the first two rounds that there was, I think, no physically possible way I could even place due to how few points I had gotten. And I was playing Ticket to Ride, and I played Ticket to Ride... Europe as well. I didn't have a chance to play Ticket to Ride Marklin, which is not only Europe, but Germany, or one town in Germany, or something. It was very specific. I could just wax on and on about this, so much so that I think I do want to save this for another podcast.
Yeah.
I will just suffice it to say that it won Game of the Year. I think it was last year or the year before, and it won Game of the Year here in the U.S., and it won it, you know, the Spiel des Jahres or whatever it is in Germany, and I can see why. It is a really fun, really good, really accessible game.
Cool.
If you are an experienced gamer and you're used to sort of, you know, Euro games, there's a lot of room, I think, for, you know, optimizing your play and for strategy and for interacting with other players, railroad lines that are coming out. And if you're not, it is still completely approachable and playable as someone doing just generally a matching game. I'm matching these colors to this line, and therefore now I own the line. I'm matching these.
Mm-hmm.
And so within the game itself, you can have several different play levels. And I think that is a really valuable and odd thing, and odd in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is a game that I swear I could take home and play with my wife and kids. You know, the kids could play it as a matching game. My wife could play it as a, you know, as sort of a board game-ish you know, medium grade game, and I could sit there and try to optimize my rail building and try to work over, you know, screwing my kids out of their, you know, their railroad line or whatever, and I could have a lot of fun doing it on that level at the same time. So as much as I'd like to talk about it more specifically and what it's like, I think I want to save that to another podcast.
Okay.
I don't want to bore everybody with another half hour of just Ticket to Ride.
We'll definitely save that for the next time. I have not played Ticket to Ride. That's one of the ones that's on my list to play someday, so I do want to hear about your experience
with that. If you haven't played it and you like sort of strategy Euro games and you're looking for something to, you know, to pick up and you've just been avoiding it, it's really good. It is.
Cool.
It was well earned as a game of the year. I completely enjoyed it. Enjoyed it so much that as I saw Ticket to Ride in various stores over the next few weeks after Kublai Khan, it took all of my willpower to not buy it every time I saw it in the store, which is probably a sign that I should go today and buy it. So.
Hey, if you're gonna play it, you can. I'll play it with you next sometime.
All right.
So anyway, that was my Kublai Khan experience. I had a great time, and I cannot wait till next year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next time, I think we will go over Nate's Kublai Khan experience, as well as Ticket to Ride.
I'm sort of happy. I think we'll probably just talk about Ticket to Ride. I think I got in about everything I wanted to say about these games.
Oh, okay, cool.
We ended up playing a lot of games together this time around.
Yes, we did.
And so I was able to sort of, sort of ride on your coattails right now. There were a couple of interesting, or unexpected things I wanted to mention about Kublai Khan. This is backing away from the games portion and more like getting into the, you know, the Khan environment.
Okay.
During Kublai Khan, I accidentally locked my keys in my car.
Oh, yes.
because one of the days I had to spend on my laptop working in my car for a little bit at a time, and I accidentally left my keys in there. And it was, I was sitting, you know, in the car knowing that there was a gaming convention, you know, 40 feet away and that I needed to be in there. And it was really horrible to lock my keys in there. The other thing is that the corn dogs and mini pizzas that they have for sale were worse this year and more expensive than ever.
The food there is
have to spend more time eating away rather than eating there.
Well, just got to bring some good stuff, I guess.
Yeah. The dealer's room had tons of great stuff.
Yeah, they did.
Another year, I spent too much money in the dealer's room. I bought a lot of stuff.
You got to just create your dealer's room budget at the start of the con, and then double that.
That's right. It's whatever it says. I'm only spending this amount. It's this amount times two. It's got to be I always find more unexpected things. Speaking of buying things, we found dice boots again.
Yes, they finally are making those again.
Right. I don't know if we've talked about these. We should probably we'll talk about that with the Ticket to Ride section or something next time. But dice boots are essentially, you know, dice towers. You drop your dice in them, and it shakes them up for you and kicks them out at the bottom. But they're made clear and made of plexiglass, and you can take them apart, and they lay flat once you take them all apart. So they're not like the big giant heavy wooden towers. And they were not being manufactured for a while, and I needed a new one, and now there were more dice boots, so I was happy.
Yeah, they had them at the Chessex booth. So either they're back in production, or they found another box of them in the back of their store that they needed to get rid of. Who knows? But
yes. We
were both able to buy another one, which was good. Yeah,
that's right. There was also a game created by Cheap Ass Games called Enemy Chocolatier,
yes.
Which was brand new, and I believe I'm the seventh person in the world to own it. Because
it had premiered right there at Kublai Khan.
It had premiered there at Kublai Khan. It had premiered at one of the vendors there in the dealer room where the first people selling it, and I had bought the seventh copy.
All right.
So I wanted to get it signed by James Ernst as long as he was there, but, well, I couldn't find him. And honestly, I didn't look that hard for him. The other thing is we got to meet Your Move Games, the makers of the awesome Battlegrounds game. We got to chat with Chad, who was there. And so, hi, Chad. And I bought the Elf Army. They are wicked cool. And so I look forward to, you know, destroying your human orc, your humans and orcs with my elves and undead.
I look forward to watering the grass with elf blood.
All right. And I think that just about wraps it up for our Kublai Khan report.
Cool.
We will be back again another time to maybe go into detail about some of these things. And some of them we played for the first time at Kublai Khan, but now we're going to, you know, buy them, own them, play them more often, so we might have more to say about them in the future.
Yes,
so
definitely.
Consider your whistle wetted for any future gaming podcasts.
wet the whistle. All right.
Yes.
Cool. All right. Well, that's the Kublai Khan report.
Well,
Well, that's the show, and I am out of here. As always, you can contact us by posting a comment on the Roll2D6 blog at www.roll2d6.com or by sending us an email at roll2d6@gmail.com. And if you like this podcast, then please give it a review wherever fine podcasts are sold. Stay tuned next time when you might hear someone say...
We played Dungeons and Dragons for 3 hours. Then I was slain by an elf.
Listen to yourself, man. You're hanging with nerds.